Mother, what interpretation? Model. So brief potted history. At the end of the 1927 Solvay Conference, De Broglie presented this interpretation, and he presented pretty much all of it, but he didn't convince people, and he himself then stopped working on it. And then in 1952, David Bohm rediscovered this approach. One of the things that David Bohm did that De Broglie didn't was that he treated measurement, so he made it more clear that this was a viable interpretation of quantum theory. Bohm used a sort of second order version of this, where you introduce something called the quantum potential. De Broglie used a first order version, where you just have a first order equation for the motion, and that's the approach I'm going to take. So basically, these two guys came up with the approach. So we start off with non-relativistic quantum theory. Non-relativistic quantum mechanics, let's call it. So we have some wave function of for various for n particles. And this wave function evolves according to the Schrödinger equation. Okay, like so. There's also I should put an explicit time dependence in as well. So I think in 1927, a lot of things weren't that clear. So I don't think there was a Schrödinger's. I mean, Schrödinger's equation existed, and De Broglie went about trying to find an interpretation of that. Bohm, by the time Bohm did his work in '52, then the Copenhagen interpretation, let's say, was out. And I think Bohm actually wrote a book, a textbook on quantum theory prior to 1952. Where he tried to clarify the Copenhagen interpretation. And I think perhaps he didn't find it very satisfactory, and that's why he tried to find an approach like this. So certainly for Bohm, that would be true. So we're going to treat this non-relativistic quantum mechanics. It's worth saying that there are also these kinds of models for quantum field theory. So you can do pretty much anything you can do in standard quantum theory, also in one of these kinds of models. And even in his 1952 paper, I think there are two papers, and in one of those papers, he treats the case of quantum field theory. But I'm just going to stick with the simplest case of non-relativistic quantum mechanics for the purposes of this lecture. Okay. So now, in the De Broglie-Bohm model, it's specified in the following way. The ontology is given by well, the ontic state, let's say, is given by specifying a wave function . Let me say the ontic state at time t, to be clear. The ontic state is given by specifying a wave function at that time. This is a wave function living on configuration space for all these different particles. And then in addition to that, we specify a position for all the particles. Okay. So in a picture, you have a wave, there's a wave, and then you also have an actual position in configuration space, and you can think there's actually a particle or a whole bunch of n particles. Each has their own position, and that constitutes a position in the configuration space. Okay. And so I use uppercase letters to represent the actual position of the particle, and then these lowercase letters just to indicate this wave function, to give you the arguments of the wave function. And sometimes it's useful to use this notation. Okay. So that's the statement of the ontology that tells you what the ontic state is at a given time. And now I want to give you the dynamics. And it's given by two coupled equations. Actually, the coupling is a strange kind of coupling. The second equation depends on the first, but not vice versa. So the first equation is that's this one. Schrodinger's equation. And the second equation is this. That these positions change, and they have a velocity which is given by that expression. Sorry, this is badly written out. So the velocity of the nth particle is given by taking this expression. Notice the n here indicates this is the derivative operator with respect to the nth particle. Okay. Yep. Does someone have a question?
starting point for calculating the derivative for x n large?
For what you mean, what the initial conditions are?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll come to that. Yeah. This that's important. And this is often called the guidance equation in literature. So if you have some initial position and you have some initial wave function, then you can find a solution to the Schrodinger equation, and you can evolve the initial position by this equation. Oh, and there's an important point here. So we do this calculation in the small x variables, but then we set small x equal to big X. Yeah. Oh, was that your question?
Yeah.
Sorry, I hadn't understood. Yeah.
So formally the wave function depends only on small x, right?
That's right, yeah. This is an equation in small x.
And
here, this, yeah, after taking the derivative, this is small x.
Mm-hmm.
Calculating this, you then set it equal mm-hmm. to the particular position particle is at. So, so a particular point that's interesting. I'll be coming back to this point later. Is notice that this is the position for all the particles in configuration space, not just the particular particle in question. So this velocity for the nth particle depends on the position occupied by all the other particles, as well as itself. And so this is where you see explicit non-locality. Any more questions?
Yeah. Kind of looks like a continuity equation,
guidance equation. Yep, yep. It is, yes. Yeah, we'll come to that. Okay. So sometimes an additional assumption is added. Let me call this 3. And we assume the additional assumption is that the probability density at time 0 is given by the modulus squared of the wave function at time 0. So this is the probability density. Probability density for finding the particles at these positions. So an immediate response to that is to say, well, isn't that just a bit artificial to assume at time 0 the thing you ought to be trying to prove? And so one can play a more interesting game where you don't make this assumption, but you try to prove that after some short amount of time, it nevertheless becomes true. So if you don't make this assumption, so if you assume this, you're saying that the system starts in equilibrium, sort of a particular kind of equilibrium. But if you don't make this assumption, then you'd be saying, well, the system starts out of equilibrium, and you want to prove that it relaxes in not too long a time to equilibrium. And Anthony Valentini has done a lot of work on that, which I'll come to, time permitting.
3, we just substituted small x's by large x's and inverted
them to 0, right? Yeah, just because these are the positions of the, this is the actual distribution for the actual particles, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Is there a problem with measurement if you assume this?
With what?
So
there's I'll cover what happens in measurement. It's quite interesting, but briefly, after measurement in the standard approach, you would just use the collapsed part of the wave function, and it turns out that you can do the same thing here. Effectively, there's a sort of an argument that says that it's unlikely to make a difference to subsequent evolution of the particle if you just use the collapsed part of the wave function. I'll cover that. Yeah, that was an important contribution of David Bohm. To show that it works for measurement in the standard way. So what happens when the system evolves? And the answer is if at time 0 the probability distribution, I'm being lazy, I'm not including all the other, all the x's in the argument. If this is true at time 0, then it's true for all subsequent times. In fact, if you have some times before time 0 and you evolve everything backwards, evolve the Schrodinger equation backwards and use this equation backwards, it's also going to be true for all earlier times. Although people don't usually do that. And the whole point of choosing the guidance equation like this was to make sure that this was true. There's been a recent discussion in the literature about this sort of property in general. So the idea is there's something called equivariance. Equivariance. So this is the idea that that we're interested in a guidance equation such that we have this property. In other words, we can either evolve this distribution forward under the guidance equation, or we can evolve the this distribution forward just by calculating the wave function and taking the modulus squared, and we get the same answer in both ways of doing it. And it turns out that actually there are that this is the unique guidance equation. As long as you make certain assumptions, you rule out certain non-local properties. So under some very basic assumptions, this is pretty much the only guidance equation you can have. There's a paper by Stroiber and Goldstein on that. It's on the archive. Okay, so let's try to understand why this works, and it's because it's a continuity equation. So and also understand the motivation for the guidance equation. So we note that this is actually, it's actually a quantity you'll find in textbooks, standard textbooks on quantum theory, which have nothing to do with the de Broglie-Bohm model, and it's the probability current. And it satisfies this equation. Let me put a vector. This is a vector. So I'll put a somewhere. Satisfies that equation. This is just you just use the Schrodinger equation to prove that. And this equation can be reinterpreted as a continuity equation. So if we make these substitutions, then we just get this is a classical continuity equation, and you can think of it as a equation for the conservation of probability in the configuration space. And this equation here gives you the guidance equation, is equivalent to the guidance equation. Okay. Any questions? No. Good. Tutorial, one of the tutorial questions concerns sketching these trajectories in the de Broglie-Bohm model. Although you can go about this by, you know, programming a computer and solving these equations, you can gain a lot of insight without doing that just by taking a couple of points into account. So it's possible for many situations to sketch the basic qualitative features of these diagrams, of these trajectories. So there's two principles that help in this. The first one is the no crossing principle. if you look at the equation for the velocity of these trajectories, then it's just a single-valued equation of the position in configuration space. So it's given by a single-valued function. So if you have a given wave function, and at some given time, this function is single-valued. And what that means is, if you have some trajectory, some particle evolving, so here we're starting the particle off at some particular initial point. It evolves in time. And then if we start off, if we consider now a different run of the experiment, so we start off in a different initial position, say over here, and now consider this and evolve this one, and solve according to the equations, then this is impossible. Because if this were possible, then you'd have a double-valued velocity. So this is forbidden. So we know that when we draw trajectories, they'd better not cross. And then the second point, is that the trajectories, as they evolve, if you have an ensemble of trajectories, if this is true initially, then it has to continue being true. So, for example, imagine I have some Gaussian. Some Gaussian wave packet. So it leads to a Gaussian distribution of initial positions. So I can have some bunch of initial positions. Let me just draw a couple. Start off in these positions. And then let's imagine this Gaussian evolves. We can imagine it doesn't spread very much, but it moves. So at some later time, it's over here. Then these trajectories are going to evolve like so. In this case. Okay. So I should say that the node crossing property is a very natural consequence, is an obvious consequence of the mathematics. But it's sort of interesting because these two particles aren't meeting, because these are different runs of the experiment. Okay, so this is not two particles meeting at the same point, but rather this particle in some sense realizes that had it started here, it would have gone along here, so it knows it can't go into that same point. It's kind of odd in that sense. It's a rather quantum effect. And it's one of the reasons you see interference in these diagrams, in this model. So another example that you can do is to sketch let's imagine we have a double slit interferometer. So what happens? Well, in the quantum theory, what happens is the wave function comes through and it spreads like so. This is the sort of envelope, if you like, of the wave function. If you have a screen up here, then in the region where these two wave functions are overlapping, you'll see interference. So you'll see some variation of the wave function, of the square of the wave function. So interference pattern at the top. It's not a very good drawing, sorry. So now the particles will come in. And here's a particle. It comes in. It initially is moving in a fairly straight line, just under the free evolution of this wave function. And then when it enters the interference region, it's going to start to wiggle. And the wiggling has to be just enough to account for the distribution so that you get this second property, so that rho is equal to psi squared. And so people have actually done this calculation properly. So here are some, I'll just hand these out. Oops. Keep one for myself. Just if you pass, maybe I'll pass it around, pass those along. That's enough. So what you can see is if you follow a particular trajectory, then it will start to wiggle. And when you get to the screen, you'll see that they're kind of bunched where the where you have the peaks of the interference pattern. And there's sort of gaps in between where you have destructive interference. So this is what happens. So it sort of naturally accounts for quantum interference. So these kinds of graphs were first plotted by Chris Dewdney and his collaborators in, I think, the late 60s, something like that, maybe early 70s. And in the meantime, David Bohm had essentially forgotten about his 1952 paper and started thinking about other things. And Chris Dewdney was a student of David Bohm. And back in those days, it was quite difficult to do these calculations. You had to do them on using stacks of punch cards, with holes in. But when he saw the results of these calculations, he became kind of convinced again that this was a viable approach to quantum theory. It's kind of very compelling when you see how it accounts for something as simple as the double slit interferometer. And so these kinds of pictures led to a revival of this particular approach. Okay, so next I want to cover measurement. How should I do this? So let's imagine we have some particle, and its wave function is in a superposition of being sort of peaked around here and peaked around here. Okay. And we can imagine that we do some experiment to measure whether it's over here or over here. And we could do that by interacting it with some second system, which we'll denote by, we'll give it the label y. And so let's imagine The second system is in an initial state phi zero, and we have evolution like this. Okay. So what's happening is the second system, we're going to call this the pointer. You know, so you can imagine that you have some measurement apparatus that has a pointer on it. And y is the pointer variable. Initially, the pointer is in the sort of zero position, but then under this interaction, the pointer either goes to one side, if we're in this state, or it goes to the other side, if we're in this state. And we're going to assume that the overlap between these two states for the pointer is very small. The overlap in position space. This is actually a stronger condition than orthogonality in the quantum sense. We actually want these two wave functions to be non-overlapping. It's possible to have wave functions that overlap in position space and yet are orthogonal. So think, for example, of the first two excited states, the ground state and the first excited state of a particle that's trapped in a well. Those states overlap in position space, but they are orthogonal. So this is a stronger condition. So now, under this evolution, the wave function will evolve to an entangled state. Like so. And we can imagine trying to draw the trajectories for this situation. Actually, let me say that differently. We can try to draw the trajectories for this situation. So this can be our time axis. This can be x. This can be y. Let me just draw this square to help the visualization. So initially, what we have is let's imagine phi zero lives sort of about here. So initially, before the interaction, what we have is in the configuration space, the wave function consists of two bits, one which is here and one which is here. And then we're going to evolve this in time. And so on this axis, we'll have, let's imagine phi A is here, phi B is here. On this axis, we'll have spreading in this direction. And if there's correlation, so this part of the x wave function is going to be correlated with this. So we'll end up moving over to here. So this is the corner nearest to the t-axis. Whereas this one will end up moving to this corner. This is the corner over here. So the wave function will sort of evolve. It's difficult to draw this, something like this. There'll probably be B, but there'll also be some spreading, but I'm not drawing that. So you can think, if you could actually see this in three dimensions, this blob goes here, and this blob goes here. Okay. And so the trajectories inside here will go up to here. And trajectories in here will go up to here. And the proportion of trajectories that go this way will just be alpha squared, because that's the proportion of trajectories that live in this region initially. And likewise over here, we have beta squared, modulus beta squared. So what about solving having effective collapse? Well, if you calculate the velocity of the x particle, let's call that particle, if you calculate this, well, we know that this is some function of the wave function in x and y. But imagine the case where y, where the initial position is in here. So y is going to end up in this packet here. And so we're never sampling the wave function over here. What this means is that the guidance equation in those cases is effectively given just by collapsing down to the part of the wave function associated with this term. We call it A. Let's do this. So if the particle y has a position which is in the support of the A term of the A wave packet, then we're not sampling the second term in calculating the velocity, and so we can just use this. And likewise, Is there any questions on this? Is it clear that that would be true? Okay. So this means the projection postulate is recovered. There is still a caveat here. We're also interested in the future evolution of this system. Now,
a quick question. I don't think I quite understand it, because it would seem like that what you're saying is you're not keeping track of the particles in your feed anymore.
That's right.
So it doesn't matter. But what if you are?
Well, no, what I'm saying is, if I want to calculate the evolution of a particle in this branch, okay, after time t, you know, just into the future, then we're not looking, when we calculate this wave function, we're only using its value at the position where this trajectory lives. We're evaluating the wave function, and we're using its first derivative as well. But we're not using any, we have no contributions from this part of the wave function. So the velocity is the same. The answer we get is the same if we just replace this wave function here with this effective wave function. So this is the important point. So the qualification is it needs to be the case that they continue to have non-overlapping support for the rest of eternity. And the justification for that that's given in Bohm's paper is, if you imagine that the pointer system is actually a big system. So So imagine it's a big system comprised of many particles, where we could take n, for example, to be 10 to the power 23, something like that. So we have, you know, a macroscopic object here. Then for such complicated systems, it's very unlikely that under normal Schrodinger evolution, they'll evolve so that there's wave function if the non-overlapping will start to overlap again. Okay. And that's the essential thing you need, that you need this sort of irreversible magnification. And then you can use this effective collapse. Okay. So people are trying to interfere big objects. So Anton Zeilinger's group in Vienna have been trying to do that. And I I can't tell you the biggest thing they've done so far. But this would be trying to magnify something as big as a pointer. Actually, if somebody then looks at the pointer, so they see that it's up and down, then you have to also involve the person as well, because they become involved in this state. So to recover interference, you'd have to collect all the particles that had gotten caught up in this entanglement and somehow reverse them so they overlap. It just becomes unfeasible, with current technology. Now, it's not really a criticism of the de Broglie-Bohm model that you could do this in principle, because if you did actually find a way to do this, to reverse that evolution and re-overlap these pointer particles, then this would be wrong. And you shouldn't use the effective wave function. You should stick with the original wave function. And so you'd see a difference between this model and models that say that you should collapse the wave function after measurement, even if you reinterfere. So it's simply saying that that this is an effective trick that you can use in those cases where you're pretty sure no such reinterference is possible. I mean, the de Broglie-Bohm model doesn't work well for finite dimensional systems because you want these sort of continuous equations in X. People, there are versions of the de Broglie-Bohm model for spin, and there are different approaches. The most standard approach, actually, you're still using the fact that you have a particle with some continuous position, and then the spin degree of freedom becomes entangled in measurements with the position degree of freedom. And that's how, you know, if you send a particle for a Stern-Gerlach, then one wave packet goes up and one goes down. And so it's the position degree of freedom that you're seeing at the end. So that's one way that people treat those. If I remember correctly, somebody called Vink looked at some sort of finite dimensional model. But the problem is that once you lose this continuity, then you're going to have stochastic processes instead of having deterministic equations. I mean, you could model that kind of thing by treating, say, interferometers. And then you have Gaussian wave packets which tend to go up or down. And whether it's in the top path or the bottom path could be your qubit. So in that case, although you have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, you're only interested in a small number of states from it. So you can model finite dimensional Hilbert spaces in that way. That's probably the best way of doing it. Okay. So I want to talk now about the non-locality in this model. So remember, I pointed out that the velocity of one particle, say particle one, is actually a function of the positions for all the other particles. So you could imagine jiggling particle two. One way to jiggle particle two would be to consider varying the potential in the Schrodinger equation as it affects particle two. So if you jiggle particle two, then you're going to affect the velocity of particle one. So this is a very explicit form of non-locality. You have instantaneous action at a distance. So incidentally, John Bell studied the papers of David Bohm, and and then he said to himself that he'd seen the impossible done. There were some theorems showing that you couldn't have a hidden variable interpretation of quantum theory. Theorem due to von Neumann, I think it appears in his famous textbook. And so many people had dismissed the idea of even having a hidden variable theory. Although it turns out that theorem has, in some sense, an obvious flaw. The assumptions are a bit too strong. And so David Bohm's, the de Broglie-Bohm model in general, is a sort of counterexample to any claim that you can't have a hidden variable theory. So John Bell was very impressed, but he noticed that it had this property that it was non-local, explicitly non-local. So then he wondered if any theory had to be, any hidden variable theory like this had to be non-local. And he was able to show that that was the case. So it's this non-locality here that's sort of the origin in terms of John Bell's motivation for Bell's theorem. So a few points. Point one. No, you need to think, well, there's some discussion in literature about how one should interpret psi. At the beginning, I said that psi was part of the ontology. I think I raised that. Psi is part of the ontology. And the reason for that is that you need to know psi in order to calculate how the particles move. It's not really possible to think of it just as a probability distribution. It ends up playing the role of a probability distribution as well, but that's a sort of separate matter. But in terms of the PBR theorem, the motivation, it's actually another example, the motivation for asking the question as to whether the wave function has to be ontic. Again, it came from the de Broglie-Bohm model because here's an example where the de Broglie-Bohm model has a certain property, namely the wave function is a real thing. And so this led to posing the question as to whether the wave function has to be real. And it was sort of after that that then Matt Pusey and his collaborators took up the question and found this proof. But the original question was posed because motivated by this equation, by this interpretation, this model. Okay. So yeah, I want to make a few points. So first of all, if the wave function for the two particles is a product state, I don't need these labels. If it's a product state, then if you calculate V1, if you calculate V1 with the big wave function for both particles, then you can see that it is just equal. The guidance equation just comes down to and probably I should have put Liz in here. Basically, the phi, the wave function for the second particle drops out. And so you just get this for the, so in the case we have a product state, in order to calculate the velocity of the particle one, you only need to look at its wave function. That's probably a very important property because otherwise you really couldn't do any calculations because any pair of particles, even if they weren't entangled, even if they hadn't been correlated by some interaction, you'd have to know the positions of all the other particles. Also, in terms of this measurement theory I gave you over there, you can see that afterwards, the effective wave function is a product state. And so it means that the particle x, as it continues after the measurement, doesn't depend on the position of the variables inside the pointer. And point two. So although this theory is very non-local, the non-locality is masked because you have probabilities. You have a probability distribution. So when we have a distribution rho equal to psi squared, then you don't see this non-locality. It's sort of washed out by probabilities. And we know that has to be true because standard quantum theory isn't non-local in this way. Just a small clarification point here. We're dealing with non-relativistic quantum theory. So it is possible for particles to spread infinitely fast. But the kind of non-locality we're talking about here is one that has to do with entanglement. And so it's a more severe kind of non-locality because it doesn't matter how far apart the particles are. It's just as strong. And if you go to some sort of relativistic treatment, then you don't have to have instantaneous action. Then even your quantum theory becomes fully relativistic. Then you don't have instantaneous spreading of wave functions. One thing that's interesting is that if you do have a distribution which is not equal to psi squared, if for some reason your particles in your ensemble are not distributed in this way, then you can signal faster than light. And this is the work of Anthony Valentini. So one of Anthony Valentini's motivations or ideas is that perhaps in the early universe, before the particles had a chance to sort of to reach equilibrium, they were out of equilibrium. So if you can find relic particles, particles that haven't interacted very much with the rest of the universe, then you may be able to find systems that have rho not equal to psi squared, And then you could use these things to signal faster than light, amongst other things. And then it's worth saying here, going back to this question right at the very beginning, we had this extra assumption that we assume that the probability density at time zero is given by psi squared. If you don't want to make that assumption, then there's a lot of work trying to showing that if you start off with some distribution which is different from psi squared initially, then very quickly it will evolve to psi squared under appropriate coarse graining. So this is also Valentini. Under coarse graining. And he has a very nice paper with Westman. Which is on the archive, where he shows some plots for system which initially starts out in a distribution which is not equal to psi squared, and then you evolve the system through like two or three cycles, and it very quickly tends to something that looks a lot more like psi squared. So that's quite compelling, I would say. Sorry? That's Westman, Hans Westman. And Anthony Valentini. So what they do is, so in this particular simulation, they start off with a particle living in a two-dimensional square well. And it starts off in a superposition of the first, I think, three excited states, maybe four or five excited states. And then, the psi squared for that thing is a sort of bumpy function which has peaks. I'm giving the long answer, not the short answer. And then they take their distribution rho to just be a Gaussian inside that box. So now they evolve forward, and the distribution becomes incredibly, at the fine grain level, becomes very irregular. But if you now, inside the box, if you just take the average distribution in squares like this and plot that value, then the thing starts to look smooth again. And after not many steps, you get something which looks like psi squared at this coarse grain level.
So the coarse graining is separate from the time evolution?
Yeah, the coarse graining is the coarse graining is just a post analysis of the data.
Okay.
Because the time evolution gives you this incredibly, irregular the wave function.
So which is the
distribution
quickly referring to? How many coarse graining steps are?
Quickly referring to how long you evolve this system for. So because it's a superposition of the first three or four excited states, there's a natural time associated with that system, given by the energy difference between steps. So you have a natural time associated with one we've sort of given you something like cycles, but I think, yeah, the system actually cycles. So if you go, so it'll go back to its initial state because it's just a superposition of ground states, of excited states. It'll go back to its initial state. So you go through three or four cycles like that, and then you coarse grain the answer that you get at the end, and it looks a lot like psi squared. It's worth looking at the paper. It's on the archive, and it's the pictures say everything much better than words. So I just want to finish with a few criticisms of the de Broglie-Bohm model. So, I mean, plus points are that it solves the measurement problem very nicely. It gives you a nice, clear picture of what's happening. So the minus points. First of all, from a practical point of view, you don't need the guidance equation to predict probabilities. So if you're just interested in doing practical calculations, you would never use it. On the other hand, of course, this course is all about quantum foundation, so we are interested in more than just doing calculations. So that criticism isn't such a strong criticism. A similar criticism is to say that the guidance equation is kind of a bolt-on. You know, you have the Schrodinger equation, and then you just add this extra, sort of bolt on this extra equation. You don't even change the Schrodinger equation. There's no back reaction from the trajectories onto the Schrodinger equation. So, you know, where does this equation come from? It would be nice if a very compelling explanation could be given as to where this equation came from. But the third criticism, and I think this is the most serious one, is what's called the many worlds in denial attack. So I haven't actually gone through many worlds approach yet. I was waiting for a reaction from Emily for that. So the many worlds in denial attack is existed for a long time in different forms, but it's really David Deutsch and then Harvey Brown and David Wallace, those people in Oxford. And the idea is the following. So you look at the ontology of the de Broglie-Bohm model, and you see it's got a wave function, and it's got this extra particle. And both those things are taken to be real. You know, so if you evolve the wave function, then you'll get all these different terms appearing in it. Now, the particles only live on top of one term. You know, if I can write this down, you'll have some big wave function. You'll have a term, you know, one which this term might correspond to the stuff that's happening in this room, you know, along with some story about the rest of the universe. But then you'll also have other terms. So the particles sort of are living in this term, but there's all these other terms. And these terms also contain, if you like, people. I mean, they contain all the structure in the wave function associated with people. But in the de Broglie-Bohm model, they're not taken to be as real as this term because this is the one where the trajectories live. So in the paper by Wallace and by Harvey Brown and David Wallace, they say, well, you could think of these as being sort of zombies or mindless hulks. So you have all the structure of people, and it's really there because these things are real. This is part of the ontology. And they're going about their daily lives doing all the things that we do, and yet they're not taken to be as real. In particular, you know, consciousness, so to speak, only supervenes on this term. And that position is taken to be a bit untenable. You know, why, if these things are real, if this is part of the ontology, and all these processes are happening, why don't those things also happen? And so this pushes the de Broglie-Bohm model, or any model in which the wave function is taken to be part of the ontology, and it doesn't collapse. It pushes it in the direction of the many worlds interpretation. You could think of this as a sort of great battle between two ships at sea, and this is a sort of torpedo fired from the many worlds interpretation right towards the de Broglie-Bohm model, causing the de Broglie-Bohm model to sink just before the many worlds model sinks itself for separate reasons that we'll talk about later. So, any questions on this before I stop?
It's a good thing to stop.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll stop here. Good.